Welcome to Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Over the last few years, there's been a rapid escalation of interest in the issue of management of patients with hepatic-only metastases, and I met with surgical oncologist Dr. Steve Curley for an update of this fascinating clinical situation. Dr. Curley began by reviewing some of the major new developments in this therapeutic strategy.
Philosophically, there's been some major changes. We've gotten away from many of the dogmatic principles that were present in the late 1980s, early 1990s. For example, people were trained at that time that if a patient had more than three or four liver metastases, they were not a candidate for curative surgery. Oftentimes, if patients presented with synchronous disease or a short interval between resection of their primary and development of metastatic disease, they were considered non-curable. And then finally, the whole issue of small volume extrahepatic disease. Again, training in those days was, well, yeah, you have one or two lung mets or you have lymph nodes in the porta hepatis, you're not curable. Well, fortunately, we've questioned all of those sort of dogmatic principles and shown them to be really incorrect. There's good data in each of those subsets of patients that curative intent is still possible. If you take the patient with synchronous disease, or if you take a patient with small volume extrahepatic disease that you can also resect, if you take patients who have more than four metastases, there is still an opportunity for long-term survival with surgical treatment in those groups.
What do we know about the results of using this approach?
Well, I'll take one subset. Let's look at the patients who have more than four metastases. Several of us, including our group at MD Anderson, the group at Memorial Sloan Kettering, a number of groups around the country have looked around that, and internationally. Renee Adam has published this from the Paul Bruce. Essentially, we all know that if you treat with surgery alone, patients with more than four metastases, their five-year survival is not as good as patients with fewer, but it's still in the range of 20 to 25%. If you add in adjuvant or neoadjuvant chemotherapy to that group, at MD Anderson, our five-year survival rate in that group was 51%. So more than four metastases, surgically resected, plus chemotherapy, half of those patients were alive 5 years later. Now, not all of them were disease-free. That's the key. As you know, we've sort of changed the landscape of these patients. Essentially, what we're finding is that more patients are living longer. They may have developed new metastatic disease or recurrence somewhere. So it was, in fact, only about 20-21% who were alive disease-free at 5 years, meaning that other 30% essentially were alive with disease. They had developed recurrence. But again, they were on treatment, and we've essentially extended their lifespan in that group.
Have there been any randomized studies looking at this?
No. And as you know, that's a real issue, is how do you get people to randomize patients in these trials? We had several trials that we tried to design through the American College of Surgeons Oncology Group, and we couldn't get buy-in, we couldn't get agreement. So unfortunately, much of this is based on retrospective and either single or multi-institution databases.
So I guess the other issue, you're talking about how things have changed, is the fact that certainly, I guess, when you were talking about the 80s and 90s, we kind of had 5-FU and that was it. Now we have other agents, particularly chemotherapy, oxaliplatin, irinotecan, biologics, bevacizumab, panitumumab, cetuximab, as we've been talking about. From your perspective as a surgeon, do you see the practical consequences of this? Do you see greater anti-tumor effect in being able to help you deal with these patients?
The answer is yes. We definitely see patients who, by even an aggressive surgical oncologist or hepatobiliary surgeon standard, presents with unresectable disease, who is downsized enough that we can then be aggressive with resecting them. We also see that it has prognostic significance in that patients who show some response to neoadjuvant therapy and who are then resected, clearly in all of our data analysis, appear to have a better long-term prognosis. So again, very similar to many other disease sites, you know, the primary rectal cancer data, gastric cancer. So there's very definitely similarities there.
This concept of using systemic therapy to, quote, make the patient resectable when they're borderline, in a way it's kind of been a little bit confusing to me, in that I think we know that usually systemic therapy doesn't sterilize the tumor. It doesn't make it go away. So what actually happens that improves the ability to do surgery?
It gives you the ability to get a negative margin where before you weren't. there are certain key sites in the liver that you simply can't resect and get a negative margin. For example, if you have a tumor involving all three hepatic veins, if you have a tumor that is essentially right on the confluence of the portal vein and the biliary structures, it may be a solitary tumor, but it's in a location where you cannot resect it and get a negative margin and leave the patient with enough liver to work.
Now, again, as a non-surgeon, I'm trying to think this thing through. Is it actually invading into, the portal vein or just close to it and the chemo pulls it back?
It's proximity and the chemo pulls it back. It's not like the situation of hepatocellular cancer where you can get actual tumor thrombus growing into these vascular structures. As you know, with metastases, it tends to be more of a pushing or proximity effect. So it's extremely rare. You can't say never, but extremely rare with colorectal metastases that we see actual vascular invasion into these major vessels.
You also mentioned the issue of the patient who presents with potentially surgical resectable disease, but yet with the primary intact, either a rectal or colon cancer. Can you kind of talk about how you think through that situation clinically?
Classically, surgeons were taught that you go ahead and resect the primary, send them to the medical oncologist, let them get some chemotherapy, and then you decide do you resect the liver metastases or not. We now realize that if the patient essentially presents with a asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic primary, meaning it's not obstructing, they're not bleeding significantly, frequently we will go right to systemic chemotherapy to treat both the primary and metastatic disease. We'll usually give them about 3 months worth of treatment and then restage. The other thing that's interesting is we now have a group of patients. For example, it's a highly selected group, but when we looked at our data at MD Anderson of these patients in the last 5 years who presented, in essentially 24% of the patients, we resected the liver metastases before we resected the primary because their primary had essentially disappeared on systemic chemotherapy. They were totally asymptomatic, but they still had liver metastases that we felt were going to be essentially what was going to influence their survival. So it's caused us to completely rethink even the order of the operations that we perform on these patients.
But you still go back and do the primary surgery?
Still do the primary. Even though, again, this goes back to the question you asked, now that you have agents that will cause a response, what does that do to us as a surgeon? We've got patients who the primary seems to disappear. It's very similar to the data on chemoradiation for rectal cancer, where a certain subset of patients, their primary will go away. You operate on them. There are some pathologic CRs, but there's an even bigger group who have microscopic disease remaining either in the wall of the rectum or in lymph nodes. The same is true for the primary and the colon. Now, this brings up another issue that heretofore I hadn't had to deal with, but now that we have active agents, what do you do with the patient who has a liver metastasis or two liver metastases that radiographically disappear after treatment? Again, fortunately, there is data on this. Bernard Nolanger presented this at ASCO, which showed that of those patients, when they went ahead and resected that area, 85% of the time, there was still microscopic metastatic disease there. So what that means is even though patients downsize, you still have to get a good margin away from the tumor. You still have to look at those areas where there once was tumor and try to include that in your resection.
So let's dissect this out, so to speak, a little bit more in terms of this primary metastatic. So let's talk about the patient who presents with a primary colon cancer, relatively asymptomatic, and surgically resectable liver mets. How do you decide between starting systemic therapy, surgery? Can you go in and do both procedures at the same time? How do you approach it?
The answer is, generally, we will give that patient systemic chemotherapy first. The exception is if you have a patient with a tumor that tends to be a centrally located tumor, meaning that, as we both know, there are some patients who actually progress on systemic chemotherapy. They don't respond. They don't have either stable or responsive disease. I always ask myself the question, if this patient were to progress on chemotherapy, could they get out of bounds? For example, they have a tumor that's near two of the three hepatic veins, and if they were to grow, it would then involve the third. In that scenario, I've actually sometimes taken the patient and done their liver resection first. Then they get systemic chemotherapy, and interestingly enough, their final treatment is resection of the primary. So that's a very small subset of patients, but those are the sorts of thought processes we're now going through when we evaluate these patients who present with stage four disease.
What are the situations, if any, where you would consider resecting the primary and liver in the same procedure?
Depends on the volume of the liver resection. Because of hepatic regeneration, we always worry, how is that going to affect healing of a primary anastomosis? The liver, of course, is a very selfish organ and uses up a lot of protein and energy to heal itself. We and others have shown that, for example, if you've got, a right colon cancer and you're not going to do a major resection, say a segment 2-3 resection or a few wedge resections, then yes, you can certainly do both. You can do a synchronous operation where you take out the primary, you deal with the liver. Now, if it's going to require, say, an extended right hepatectomy, taking out 75 or 80% of the liver, and a very difficult rectal case where you're going to have to do a coloanal anastomosis, no, you would not do both of those at the same time. That would simply be too much and would be too risky to the patient.
What about the patient who has a symptomatic primary, again, either colon or rectum, which is going to make you take the patient to surgery, but again, the patient has surgically resectable liver mets? Again, would you do it in the same procedure, same guidelines you just mentioned?
Rarely. I won't say never, but rarely. Again, if it's, say, a obstructing right colon cancer and they've got a solitary met when you do intraoperative ultrasound in segment 2-3, yes, I would probably do that. Conversely, if it's going to require a major liver resection, I would not do that at the same time. I would go ahead and stage the patient with intraoperative ultrasonography to confirm that there's not other disease, but I would tend to resect the primary in that case, give the patient systemic chemotherapy, and then come back.
What about the patient who has hepatic-only disease, the primary's been removed in the past, for example, and the patient is surgically resectable at this point? Do you generally go ahead and do the surgery, or do you utilize neoadjuvant systemic therapy first?
Well, again, it's not a straightforward answer. It depends on whether or not the patient received adjuvant therapy after resection of their primary. If they did, you have to look at what adjuvant therapy and the duration. We do know that chemotherapy has an effect on the liver. For example, we know that irinotecan does have an association with causing non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. FOLFOX, oxaliplatin-based regimen, can cause what we surgeons like to call blue liver. It's a sinusoidal vasculitis of the liver, essentially. So if the patient has already received a significant amount of chemotherapy, we will frequently go ahead and resect them first. Conversely, if the patient is chemotherapy naive, which admittedly is a very small subset, we may go ahead and give them 2 to 3 months, no more, of systemic chemotherapy, as you mentioned, tends to be FOLFOX plus bevacizumab, dropping the bevacizumab out for their last dose so that they have an adequate time period between their last dose of the bevacizumab and their surgery, and then resecting them and following that with another 3 months of chemotherapy, sort of a sandwich technique, if you will.
What's your take in terms of optimally who should be doing these kinds of procedures, and when do you think a patient maybe ought to be managed in a tertiary care setting?
Certainly, it depends on the training and the experience and the comfort of the surgeon. There are very well-trained general surgeons who can certainly do a standard segmental or lobar liver resection and do it well and do it safely. That's the key. Conversely, if it is a patient who's going to require a very difficult procedure, again, an extended resection, tumor near key structures. I haven't even mentioned, but I guess I'll use this to segue to mention, if it's a patient who's going to require a specialized technique, for example, portal vein embolization, before they get a resection, they should go to a tertiary center.
When do you do that?
Portal vein embolization, essentially, if you look at a patient and say, okay, you do a volumetric CT scan, you say, okay, this is resectable, but I'm going to leave the patient with less than 20% of their liver volume, the risk of postoperative liver failure in that scenario is very high. And liver failure generally means death of the patient. So in that scenario, we would perform portal vein embolization of the areas of the liver that are going to be resected to cause compensatory hypertrophy of the remaining liver. And then 4 to 6 weeks later, go ahead and proceed with the resection.
What do you see in terms of the difference between these patients being managed in a tertiary setting? I mean, you just gave an example of a specific procedure, but compared to a community setting, are there technical pitfalls in the procedure? Is it the supportive care? Is it both? What are some of the, I'm not going to say pitfalls, but what are some of the areas of expertise that patients receive in tertiary centers?
Well, essentially, dealing with these livers that have, say, if you've done a portal vein embolization or if the patient has had extensive chemotherapy and has an element of steatosis or steatohepatitis, the answer is yes, those are livers that we in a tertiary center deal with all the time and recognize essentially a decision-making process. When is it safe to proceed with resection and when is it not? again, based on our own data at MD Anderson, when we reviewed complications and mortality, what we realized is that patients who had received significant amounts of irinotecan did have a higher morbidity and mortality rate. We actually saw that more patients developed liver failure. Even though we left them with an adequate volume of liver, their liver was severely affected by the irinotecan-induced steatohepatitis.
What are some of the technical challenges in this type of surgery?
Well, liver surgery historically was always sort of one of those frightening areas for surgeons. Very high vascular supply, high blood rate. Bleeding was considered a big issue. When I trained, probably a third to two-thirds of the patients received blood transfusions during or immediately after the operation. So many of us who were very interested in this looked at better ways. For example, I can tell you our blood transfusion rate now at MD Anderson is less than 4% for a major liver resection. So we've developed techniques that allow us to do these operations much more rapidly, much more safely in terms of risk to the patient, need for transfusion. You really need to be comfortable with the blood supply of the liver. You need to be trained to use intraoperative ultrasonography to understand the association of tumor with blood vessels, where to resect to make sure you get a negative margin. That's something that I think needs to be emphasized and oftentimes isn't. You may be perfectly comfortable doing a liver resection, but if you aren't trained in intraoperative ultrasonography, you may miss lesions. Even in this day of age of modern CT and MRI scanning, we looked at our findings on intraoperative ultrasound, and we found that 12% of the time we found additional lesions with intraoperative ultrasound that were not seen on preoperative imaging.
Have surveys been done, or do you have any feeling in terms of how often intraoperative ultrasound is used in a community setting?
The answer is we do have a feeling for that, and if they have a surgical oncologist who's been trained in the technique, it's done routinely. Intraoperative ultrasonography is not a part, unfortunately, of standard general surgery residency training, so most general surgeons would not be using it routinely.
So if I'm a referring doc, let's say medical oncologist, would that be a way to sort of figure out whether or not the surgeon I'm dealing with should be operating on my patient's liver?
That's a fair question to ask the surgeon. Do you perform intraoperative ultrasonography on every patient you do a liver resection on? If the answer is no, that's probably not the right person to do the operation.
Interesting. What about the patient who has concomitant hepatic disease? How often do you see that, and how much does it complicate the situation?
Certainly, you do occasionally find a patient who has colorectal metastatic disease, who has concomitant cirrhosis, whether it be from previous hepatitis infection, alcoholic-induced, whatever. In that patient, you know, you may have a solitary metastasis that's in an area that technically is resectable, but again, the presence of that cirrhosis completely changes it. There, you need to leave an even larger volume of liver than you would. And that 20% number I quoted earlier is a patient with normal liver. If you take a cirrhotic, that number probably increases somewhere between 40 and 60% of the liver that you need to leave. So, for example, let's say you're going to need to do a formal right hepatectomy and take out 65% of the liver. You may say, I can't safely do that in this patient because they will develop liver failure. In that scenario, you may need to use an ablative technique, radiofrequency ablation, microwave coagulation, something of that nature.
Now, you mentioned the issue of bevacizumab in surgery. And of course, this is an issue in breast cancer, lung cancer, wherever bevacizumab is being used in terms of the question of delayed wound healing. What's been your observation? I guess most people leave, what, about 6 weeks?
6 weeks, right.
For between Bev and surgery. When you do that, do you run into problems?
We actually presented our data on that at the Society of Surgical Oncology meeting last year, and the answer is no. Waiting 6 weeks, we had no increased complication rate after major liver resections, and we looked at two things, wound healing and liver regeneration. Because again, there's very good experimental data that bevacizumab also impairs hepatic regeneration. So waiting 6 weeks, we had no problem.
It's interesting. I guess there's this sort of general issue about bevacizumab in surgery, obviously not just hepatic surgery that's out there. I guess the other thing that people hear about bevacizumab is, quote, bowel perforation. What's your take on that?
And like everybody who uses bevacizumab, we have seen that in some of these patients. That's always a concern. We talked earlier about the patient who presents with stage 4 disease, so their primary is intact, and we're going to give them FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. We have had a few patients who did perforate, interestingly enough, not always at the tumor, sometimes proximal, a couple of distal. So it's always something that we warn the patient that we're going to have to follow, and we tell the patient, should you develop certain symptoms, you know, severe abdominal pain, obviously any types of peritonitis, they need to report right away so we can take care of it. And it's a real issue. Then you obviously are forced to operate on the patient. You're operating on a patient at an inopportune time because they've received bevacizumab.
Although, you know, I don't know how many cases have been accumulated or whether it's been reported, but obviously there are people out there who got operated on, as you said, because they needed it with Bev on board. Do you know what's been seen in terms of wound healing or...
Well, in that scenario, you know, you're dealing with a perforation. Essentially, you go into a very conservative mode. Most of those patients are going to end up getting just a bypass procedure, meaning a colostomy or an ileostomy. You're not going to try and do a major resection and an anastomosis in that case. Or if you do resect them in anastomosis, you're still going to protect them with a proximal stoma. Wound healing is always an issue. You know, how well does their fascia heal? How well does their skin heal? Frequently, those patients will be left with only their fascia closed and skin open to allow better healing.
But I mean, a lot of this is theoretical considerations. Have we actually seen it play out in practice?
Honest answer is I don't know. I mean, the data, it's such a small subset.
Right.
You know, all of us in the surgical community talk about it, but is there any real hard data on it yet? No.
You mentioned extrahepatic disease that is a consideration for surgical resection in addition to hepatic resection. What kinds of locations or mets are you talking about?
Essentially, it's not infrequent that you will find a patient with liver metastases may have metastases in the lymph nodes in the porta hepatis. And so in that scenario, if you can resect that, essentially do a lymphadenectomy, again, there is a potential for survival benefit for the patient. The more common group that we see is patients who present with either synchronous or metachronous liver and lung metastases. So they may have resectable liver metastases or may have already had their liver resection done, and then they show up with one or two lung metastases that are technically resectable. And again, we have data in several other places, Memorial, Johns Hopkins, other places have presented this data that show that, again, surgical treatment of those lung metastases can provide long-term survival benefit in a subset of patients.
Now, are those resections ever done with thoracoscopy?
Yes. The VATS technique, the so-called VATS, yes. As a matter of fact, our thoracic surgeons will frequently perform VATS on those patients that are appropriate. They'll go the opposite extreme. We've got a couple of patients who presented with, say, three or four metastases, one or two in each lung, where they've either done bilateral VATS or in a couple of cases, if they were too close to the hilum of the lung, they've actually done the old-fashioned median sternotomy and gone after all of them in one setting.
What about peritoneal mets?
Well, peritoneal mets generally is sort of the bane of the hepatobiliary surgeon. You know, there's still a small subset of patients who we will open or start with a laparoscopy and with a plan for a liver resection and find that they have peritoneal carcinomatosis. In general, that stops us cold. There is the occasional patient who has very small volume disease, but they're so rare that generally they're not a candidate for resection. Again, even if you look at the other side of that, what about the patient population who may be a candidate for peritonectomy, hyperthermic peritoneal perfusion? Liver metastases in that group is usually an exclusion. So unfortunately for both groups, in liver metastases, the presence of carcinomatosis stops us as a hepatobiliary surgeon, and vice versa, if you're a peritoneal surgeon, presence of liver metastases frequently will stop you.
A peritoneal surgeon?
That's a new term, isn't it?
Peritoneal surgeons?
Yes.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We've got two at my place.
Paul
Mansfield and Laura Lambert are both experts in dealing with patients who have carcinomatosis and very aggressive surgical approaches. As you know, there are protocols available, both with pseudomyxoma peritonei, colorectal cancer, where they will go in and, to their greatest extent possible, resect all of the peritoneal disease and then do a hyperthermic peritoneal chemotherapy perfusion.
Hyperthermic? What do they actually do?
It's a long operation. You're talking about an 8 to 12 hour operation to resect the peritoneal disease. They will then place catheters in four quadrants of the abdomen and perfuse a heated solution that includes chemotherapeutic agents, generally mitomycin C in colorectal cancer metastases. And that perfusion will be ongoing for about an hour. They'll then remove the catheters and close the patient.
How hot and why heated?
Well, that goes back to the old data with hyperthermic limb perfusion for melanoma, where it was found that the hyperthermia does two things. One, cancer cells are more sensitive to heat than normal cells. And two, there's very good data that it potentiates the cytotoxic effect of the chemotherapy drug. So the hyperthermia, again, very little data that's randomized in this. Unfortunately, a lot of this has just become practice. There is certainly some data on the role of hyperthermia for limb perfusion, but in terms of for peritoneal perfusion, a lot of it is extrapolated from that data.
What's the temperature they use?
44 to 45 degrees centigrade.
What's that in Fahrenheit?
In Fahrenheit, that's what, about 110, roughly 110.
So how do these patients do post-op? Sounds like a rough experience.
It's a rough operation. Many of these patients are hospitalized for 14 to 21 days. I believe our median hospital time at MD Anderson for our patients is right at between 10 and 14 days. It's not like a patient undergoing just a good old-fashioned colon resection who's in for 5 to 6 days. Even our median stay for a major liver resection at MD Anderson is only 6 days. So it is a big deal. It's a long operation. Patients are frequently in the hospital for a long time. Ileus is a real problem afterwards, complications related to the operation. They do get some systemic effect from the chemotherapy. They can get, in some case, profound immunosuppression for a brief period of time. So it's a big deal. It's nothing to enter lightly.
Can you talk a little bit about RFA for liver lesions and other local therapies?
Well, as you know, I was kind of one of the big proponents of RFA early on. We did a lot of the early studies in RFA. And RFA, I think, still has a role, although I'm using it less and less. Our own data, again, published from MD Anderson, when we looked at what happens to patients, when you compare resection versus RFA, we found that the survival rate with resection was almost double that of the patients with RF. RF, the problem is if I resect a lesion, I know it's gone. I can pathologically confirm that the lesion is out and that I got a negative margin. With RF, I'm asking a piece of equipment to completely kill the tumor and any microscopic extensions that may exist around it. And those pieces of equipment are imperfect. Again, it is not an easy technique to learn. It requires a very good familiarity with liver anatomy and use of ultrasound to place the needles. And even then, even in my own hands, and I admit, if anything, over-treat, I get very frustrated because even in that scenario, we still had 5 or 6% of the patients who the tumors were incompletely destroyed. And in that scenario, we haven't helped the patient. We've left residual disease. The numbers presented by other groups who are not as cautious, not as meticulous, I've been flabbergasted by at times. They can be as high as 20 to 40%. They call it local recurrence. I call it what it is. It's incomplete treatment. And in that case, you've not helped the patient.
What are the complications or side effects with RFA?
There is about a 10% complication rate, and it's almost invariably related to damage to normal tissue. The one exception is obviously you can get an abscess in the lesion. That rate is very low, but it can happen. You can get an infection in the ablated lesion. The other complications tend to be damage to surrounding organs, damage to the stomach, damage to the colon, damage to the diaphragm. And then the one that's really the greatest fear of any of us doing this is damage to the bile ducts, where the patient gets either a biliary stricture or a biliary fistula.
Is there sort of a limit in terms of the size of a tumor that can be radiofrequency ablated?
Well, people have gone after some really big tumors with it. If you've got the patience and the time to do it, again, you have to overlap multiple zones. The larger the lesion, the greater the likelihood of incomplete treatment. Our own data showed that. We showed that once we started treating lesions more than 4 centimeters in diameter, the risk of incomplete treatment went up markedly. So I currently do not treat tumors bigger than 3 centimeters with RF ablation, simply because I do not believe the equipment can adequately handle them.
Can you describe a typical clinical scenario where you'd use RFA?
Frequently, I would use it in colorectal cancer patients who present with bilobar disease. Let's say they've got 2 fairly large metastases in the right lobe and perhaps 1 small one in segment 2, segment 3. In that scenario, if I feel that, okay, I can do the right hepatectomy, but based on the location of that other lesion, I can't do a resection of that lesion as well and leave them with enough liver. Again, if it's a small lesion, 1-2 centimeters, I'll then radiofrequency ablate that lesion. And those patients actually can do quite well.
What about other local modalities? Anybody ever use cryo anymore?
There still are some people who are proponents of cryotherapy. Again, they state, which is correct, the advantage is unlike radiofrequency ablation, where monitoring the treatment real time is very difficult, there's no good correlation with what you see on ultrasound and the actual zone that you kill. With cryo, you can see the ice ball forming very nicely on ultrasound, and it tends to correlate with the area of destruction. The other new technology that's coming online is microwave coagulation. Again, like radiofrequency, it's a heat-related therapy. And the advantage of it is that it's much faster than radiofrequency ablation. Probably takes about 20% of the time that a radiofrequency ablation does. Like radiofrequency ablation, it is very nonspecific, meaning that it will probably have the same kind of complications. You could potentially damage structures near the probe that you place.
What about percutaneous RFA or RFA through laparoscopy?
Have done very little of that for colorectal. That is, I think, a very good treatment for hepatocellular cancer, where, again, you're frequently dealing with a damaged or a cirrhotic liver. I've done both percutaneous and laparoscopic guided in that scenario. There are interventional radiologists who will do percutaneous RFA for colorectal cancer. I tend to think that's a mistake a good part of the time, particularly if it is a resectable lesion. And I can tell you I probably do 20 resections a year on patients who have had a percutaneous RFA and a lesion was incompletely treated. The problem with percutaneous treatment is, again, the image guidance is even more poor there because now you're going through the skin. It's not like an intraoperative ultrasound where I'm laying the probe right on the liver. So whether you're using either ultrasound or CT guidance, you have to position the needle, position the patient. It's just a bigger deal to put them through. The putative advantage is the fact that it is percutaneous and it's almost an outpatient procedure, but you have to weigh that with the fact that the risk is you have a much higher incomplete treatment rate.
If you have a patient who has what appears to be surgically resectable liver disease, what do you consider standard in terms of imaging?
For us, it's a three-phase liver protocol CT. At MD Anderson, we love the CTs. Our CT and body imagers are excellent. Again, a high-quality MRI scan would also be good. MRI, I don't think, is quite as good for imaging extrahepatic disease. That's why we prefer CT. We will occasionally find a patient who we think has liver-only disease, and they'll have something suspicious in the peritoneal cavity or lymph nodes. And in that scenario, if we do see something suspicious in an extrahepatic site, we'll routinely add a PET scan. But that tends to be the only time we'll do a PET. I do not do a PET scan on every patient who presents with liver metastases. It's really only if the imaging suggests there may be something extrahepatic.